Publisher Trinity Mirror is buying the owner of the Daily Express and the Star in a deal worth more than £126 million. It also gives the company control of celebrity magazines, including OK.
Taken all the hassle and stress out of rent collection for landlords with a brand new rent collection service.
Welcome back, boys and girls. David Bowie doing his little bit. Actually, it's not a little bit. It's quite a big bit. It's a good song, Suffragette City, because this week there was pre-Sybil celebrations across the country, but especially in Bristol. It's 100 years of women's suffrage in the UK this week. If you're over 30 years old and a woman of property. I had hoped during my curation of this week's broadcast that I would get a number of local political female voices into the studio, but between the vicissitudes of my incompetence and apparently some technical problems with IT servers at council and other levels, we are bereft, apart from Green activist Annika Sutcliffe. Welcome to the studio.
Good evening.
How do you do?
I'm very well.
Excellent. Now, I had always intended to have you in on this show. Outside of the suffragette issue, I wanted to talk, first of all, about you as a younger generation political activist and being politically motivated and minded a lot of the time. Talk about some of the green issues and talk more broadly about the city that Bristol has become for people of your generation, because it's relatively unaffordable. It's getting hassly. And, you know, I think there might be a bit of brain drain just around the corner because good people can't afford to stay here. But before we get to all of that, let's talk about 100 years of female suffrage in the UK. How have you felt this week?
This week?
Yeah, because there's been celebrations, there's been marches. Bristol was, you know, pretty much front and centre in the fight. You know, there's tales of suffragettes hiding out in the organ pipes at the Colston Hall and leaping out and saying votes for women. And Winston Churchill, who was at the time, I think, the Secretary for Ireland, being assaulted with dog whips at Templemead Station. And, of course, a number of the local suffragettes ended up in Horfield Prison being force-fed. It was a political decision for them to commit crimes, to go to jail, to make their voice heard, to get as much momentum behind their cause as possible.
Well, first, I'd like to say I'm a bit ashamed as a woman that you know more about this than I do. But I do think it's been a really significant last couple of years for women. The marches that happened when Trump was elected and, you know, the general sort of leaps towards further equality in jobs and in, well, all sorts of areas. So it's an exciting time. I wrote an article only last year about a female conductor and how, you know, there are certain professions that are still very male dominated, and and it is time for women to be able to do what they want.
Okay, if we look at, you know, you mentioned the last two or three years. First of all, I guess we have to probably mention Mumsnet, which has obviously become a bit of a sounding box for the stay-at-home mum, the female voice, the previously unheard voice, because when you're not in the workplace and you're not really keeping adult company as much as you could because of the younger people in your life, there's that. Then the horror stories of the Me Too campaign, not just the celebrity ones, but, you know, the knee-touching and the inappropriate suggestions and all of this sort of stuff. A little bit of women's inequality, dare I say it, in sport, with the former Bristol ladies football coach being removed from his position with the England ladies team. And we're seeing a little bit more of this trickle down in the States and you know, in the UK more broadly as well. And then we come back to workplace equality, equal pay for equal job, all of this sort of stuff. It's becoming an avalanche.
It is a bit, yeah. And I think the certainly the Me Too episode affected a lot of people. I think that it was significant for a lot of women to be able to speak out about things. And a lot of men started to get very fed up with it as well. My news feed on my social media, I found it fascinating. There actually were quite a few men admitting to having crossed the line and were apologising publicly. And I think that did raise a level of awareness over some issues for women. And, you know, a lot of people were making a point that, oh, it's often the other way around. You know, women push themselves on men just as much. But it's not just as much. I think that was the point. And I think it's done a lot for confidence of certain women. And it's brought things into conversation, which I think is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. It's being talked about.
It is being talked about, but there is also, you know, if you look at Catherine Deneuve and the 100 and odd other signatories of the, you know, right to choose rebuttal, not maybe a rebuttal, but, you know, a kind of a paean for trying to find some middle ground. And mm-hmm. she was internationally vilified for it.
Well,
you know, it's difficult. You two over on the other side of the desk, men of a certain age, I don't mind calling you. Have we been that awful for that long?
I don't think I have, but I think men collectively have. Yeah. I suppose if I think about, you know, when I was a teenager and the sort of male company I kept, there probably were some pretty un-PC attitudes amongst which I don't repeat on the radio now.
Well, indeed. And Martin Summers, I mean, you've been a political animal for your entire adult life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you remember the sort of the new lad era of the face and so on, there was a kind of recrudescence of previous attitudes. Mm-hmm. And it was in a way a reaction to you know, the more, you know, po-faced elements of feminism. But then that itself went sour, because it just, you know, there are some things that's just not acceptable. They weren't acceptable really in the 19th century when we had chivalry and so on. And you know, some people just got a bad attitude, and often it's men that have that bad attitude because they're the ones with the power.
Can we blame the curriculum for this?
Curriculum in schools?
Yes.
Well, in what way, Billy?
Well, you know, I was educated, I think, quite well. I speak with accurate grammar most of the time. I don't remember there being an awful lot of female heroines in my history books.
That's exactly what I wanted to just bring in, actually, saying education's key here. I had one of the most expensive educations in the country in my teens, and I don't remember being taught about female pleasure or really about consent in fullness. And I remember the boys growing up with attitudes from having seen pornography already and things like this. I don't think education really prepared women to be empowered and able to say what they want or don't want, and I don't think they prepared the young boys to know how to really act mm-hmm. appropriately. So I would say it's almost 100% down to education and how our teenagers are growing up and all of the pressures on women from the current media and all that sort of thing. I feel for teenage girls at the moment, the amount of pressures on them.
Okay. There was an active policy within the Labour Party, you know, in the last 20 years to make sure that there was all female shortlists.
Yep.
To ensure that there was gender equality, equal gender representation as much as possible within the elected chambers. Is this a good idea, or should, frankly, the best person for the job be put forward for the job?
Well, it was in Scandinavia that this was pioneered, and it worked very well. I mean, the, you know, women's representation at that sort of level went up enormously when they brought in women's only shortlists. And I think as long as, you know, we keep a sense of proportion about it, I don't think there's any problem with it.
Okay.
I have a slightly different view. I imagine the male candidate who's the best for the job but isn't going to get the place because of quotas. You know, I think there is a legitimate argument that says, you know, that's the wrong way to go about it. The way forward is to encourage women to, you know, to meet those quotas, but at every stage it should be based on merit. An alternative way around it might be to say, well, we could have dual MP constituencies. You've got to elect a man and you've got to elect a woman. How about that?
Okay. Isn't that, you know, that quotas thing? Of another kind?
Well, yes, but then we got, you know, you could argue that you could argue that women make up half the population. I'm kind of arguing against myself here, but I think that there probably is a way around it, which is fair to women, but which doesn't deny the best man for the job, if he is a man, from getting the job.
Mm. Okay.
I think having an entire room of men deciding on something that's to do with women's birth control.
Well, I totally agree.
There is a little bit of that.
But shall I give you an interesting observation that struck me the other day? If we look at the new leader of the DUP, Mrs. Arlene Foster, lady, new leader of Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, Michelle O'Neill, lady, our current Prime Minister, Theresa May, lady, current leader of the SNP, Nicola Sturgeon, lady, current leader of Plaid Cymru, Leanne Wood, lady, current leader of the Green Party, Caroline
Lucas.
Thank you, lady, current leader of... I had one more.
I did have one more. It's not UKIP, is it?
No.
It's not Labour.
Oh, yes, it is. No, the lady stepped down from UKIP candidacy, didn't she?
Yeah.
There was one other which escapes me. Oh, yes, the leader of Scottish Labour and Scottish Conservatives.
Yes, that's right.
Kezia Dugdale and
Ruth
Davison. Thank you. Yes. No, we've been banging this drum.
So, job done. We don't need feminists
anymore.
No,
all our MPs in Bristol, might I add.
Exactly. Four of the MPs in Bristol, ladies. Mm. The point I would make is, I don't think we can't acknowledge the fact that things have not been as bad in the UK for a long time as they are now. Is this scapegoating?
So you're saying that we've got a lot of women in charge and we're going
and
to hell in a handcart, are we?
Yeah. Well, Theresa May is a different case. She was the least worst candidate for the job. Let's be honest about this. When David Cameron stepped down, nobody wanted that job.
Right,
and
yeah.
Theresa May was slightly better than Andrea Leadsom with her fully functioning ovaries. Nobody voted her in. The public did not want Theresa May to run the Conservative Party or to be the Prime Minister, as evinced by the amazing snap election result when she put the whole of Britain's negotiating platform in the thrall of the DUP, which are probably the worst people you would like to try and curry favour with.
Well, I would say, you know, yes, what a terrible bunch of idiots we've got. I mean, Theresa May is hopeless. And this is the thing. Apparently, I read today that the bookies' favourite to be the next Prime Minister is Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yeah, I just
And, you know, so we have in both Labour and the Conservative Party hopeless leaders. Jeremy Corbyn's hopeless. And there's no obvious successor for either of them that is in any way competent.
Okay. Martin Summers, you're an old Labour economist.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have seen the peaks and troughs. I genuinely cannot think of another time in British political history when the leaders of so many political parties and significant groups were female.
Well, I think that just shows that it's become normalised for women to be the leaders, and I think there's a problem with that. I mean, I don't agree with all of those politics of those women. I don't agree with the politics of Margaret Thatcher. I must have demonstrated hundreds of times against her policies, and the fact that she was a woman in that era, there was actually an anti-female element to the kind of chants that people used to come out with and so on. But it was really her policies that I objected to, not the fact that she was a woman.
And in contrast to what I've just said, of course, Nicola Sturgeon is, you know, regardless of whether you disagree with her or agree with her, and obviously she's not so relevant because she's SNP in Scotland, but she is a very competent leader, you know, and has that, you know, if she was running Labour or Conservatives, they'd win the election hands down. Yeah, because she's Scottish, that's the problem with her.
Martin,
from an English perspective,
you're going to get a whole five million Scottish people's backs up now. Annika Sutcliffe, you're a politically motivated female. How is this for you? Surely this is the moment. This is the moment for the female in politics.
I mean, yeah, the list you just reeled off, I hadn't really thought of it that way. Yes, there's a lot of women at the forefront right now. Some of them I really agree with, some of them I don't. One that you didn't mention is Mary Black, who shouts a lot.
Well, Mary, she's the youngest MP. She's the baby of the house, MP for Paisley.
I agree with a lot of what she says, and I think that the fact that she has to sort of shout it so strongly is saying something, though, and it's as if she won't be heard unless she does shout it that strongly. And I think there's still this idea that women have to work harder and fight harder against a tide to get to the top. But maybe the current situation has disproved that entirely.
Well, we shall see. We're going to come back and talk about Labour locally and nationally, and Labour ladies locally and nationally. Stay where you are, Bruce Williamson, because I want your voice and your opinions on this on the Friday Politics Show with me, Billy Quain, sitting in on Bristol Community 93.2 FM for Tony Gosling, who's on his holiday. Halls, Martin Summers, old Labour economist, transport consultant Bruce Williamson from Rail Future, and Annika Sutcliffe are with me in the studio. Annika Sutcliffe, green campaigner, and generally gallabout town, libraries are under severe threat.
They are, yeah. There's some really sad news this week if you're a musician particularly and like to use the Bristol Central Library, because they have announced that funding is no more, and the Bristol Music Library, which was housed in the Central Library, is closing entirely. They say there's only 29 users, but most of those people represent an entire orchestra or choir, and so the effects and ripples go out far further.
So we can extrapolate the 29 users out, because each one of these organisations will have one librarian.
Exactly.
So we're talking about...
may affect 50 or 100 people in that organisation that regularly hire music from our library. And then they may have an audience of 500 performances. So
potentially 5,000 users and 25,000 to 50,000 audience members, participants. Well done, guys. That's excellent work. Not only have you cut music tuition in schools, you've now removed the opportunity to self-tutor oneself. So thanks for that.
Really sad. Yeah. But the good news is I did have a conversation with somebody from Bristol Plays Music, which is our musical education hub in the city. And it's down to people like myself to try and have these conversations. And somebody from Making Music has been helping us as well. Bristol Plays Music looks like they will be able to house the collection of music, possibly.
Ah, that's good news.
And we're working on getting it still being available. But basically, things are falling into the people's hands, I think, because the council are no longer being
Bristol
able to
fund. Bristol Plays Music is also
stuff.
On a stipend from the council.
From Bristol Music Trust, which, yes.
Which is part of the council. Yes, it's the organisation that took over the Colston Hall and music education for the state side
of
the city.
They pretty much control any funding that goes anywhere near music in the city.
Well, it sounds like they've moved something from the in tray on one desk to the out tray on another desk, probably facing each other on the desk. Desks opposite each other. Anyway, enough. I want to talk to Martin Summers, Bruce Williamson and Annika Sutcliffe about the avalanche of youth political membership, especially within Labour. I'm making more specific reference to the Momentum movement. Also, Annika, to the Green Party locally, which, to be fair, I mean, the Green Party has had probably the best international advertising it could ever and will ever get, with David Attenborough's final episode in Blue Planet 2 begging for changes in law and packaging and banning of plastics, or using far fewer plastics. We'll come on to that. Let's talk about Martin Summers, the activisation, I won't say the militation, but Corbyn fought twice to remain as leader of the Labour Party. Frankly, I had my doubts. He was a stride forwards from Moses Miliband. But by the same token, I'm not sure that he had much support within his parliamentary group. But the membership kept him in twice.
Yeah, they did. And also new people joined in order to join that fight. So in actual fact, the two campaigns inside the Labour Party to keep him in place actually had people all fired up. And then when Theresa May makes the tactical decision to call the election, everybody was really fired up because of the two internal fights we just had. And that just carried over into the election campaign in terms of people just girding themselves up and they were ready to go. And of course, we didn't win. but we weren't expected to, and he did pretty well.
Well, as a lifelong Labourist, did Labour want to win? Really?
No, because we want the sky's going to fall in on the head of whoever inherits the mess. So we met, from my point of view as a rugby fan, this was a perfect 2020 kick. Yeah? They can pick up the ball on their own on their own try line, and we're going to run it over them.
Okay. Bruce Williamson, we have a number of former shadow Labour cabinet members, Kerry McCarthy being spokesperson for agriculture, the vegan spokesperson for agriculture,
right,
representing Bristol East, I think. We had Thangnam Debonair for Bristol West resigning her whip over something quite recently in open revolt with the leadership.
Yeah.
That's not going to win any friends in high places, that
no,
sort
it's
of behaviour.
No, but I was sympathetic. I'm not a fan of Jeremy Corbyn because, you know, as was proved at the last election, he hasn't got what it takes to win an election. And Thangnam Debonair was quite rightly looking down the barrel of the next election saying, we're going to lose. It's time to change tactics. It's time to change leader. Corbyn can't win. And he didn't. He lost.
Well, her majority was massively increased.
Indeed. So what does that tell you? You know, that she was right and Corbyn was wrong. I mean, you know, Theresa May, I'm sure you'd all agree, Theresa May was absolutely hopeless at the last election.
She didn't try to win a campaign at all.
Well, exactly. So that's an open goal. It's an easy win. And he can't even win against an opponent on the back foot. So if the Tories get a competent leader, Corbyn is finished. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I'd be interested to get your perspective on the Greens, because all the other parties got squeezed at the last election. Yeah. It was you know, massively Labour, massively Tory. Lib Dems, Greens, UKIP relatively poorly performed. Mm-hmm. And I think what happened is that there was such opposition from the opponents of both leaders. So many people hated the Tories that they went for Labour, and so many people hated Corbyn that they went for the Tories, and the middle ground got squeezed.
In Bristol West, the previous election, it was looking like Greens could
yes,
take it.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
It was actually really close between Greens and Labour, and then this last election, it appeared anyone that had actually wanted to vote Green actually still voted Labour, because it just turned into a two-party race.
Yeah, yeah.
I proudly did still vote Green and failed to convince my three other housemates who had voted Green previously to still vote Green, and they went.
Yeah, because it's the number two target in the country, isn't it, for the Greens? Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Bristol West.
Well,
yeah.
If we look at local representation, we do have 11 Green councillors in the South West, although her job is going to become a non-job in about a year's time. We do have a Green MEP.
Yes.
There's an argument
Molly
to say
Scott
Thangnam,
Cato, yeah.
Yeah. Thangnam Debonair is almost more Green than Molly Scott Cato.
Right.
If you actually
right.
look at what she's been helping push forward in terms of green spirited campaigns.
Yeah.
She's all over the banning single-use plastics and all of this sort of stuff.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because Natalie Fee's Bristol founded campaign, City to Ocean, has gathered a lot of traction in the last 18 months. Congratulations, Natalie. I'm really pleased that people are actually listening, and the message is starting to spread a bit, and people are copping on. Don't buy a bottle of water if you can get perfectly good water out of the tap. Or dare I say it, if you can get perfectly good water out of the tap, fill up your own reusable bottle at home.
You could buy a good water filter if you're really concerned about the water from the tap.
I was going to say the opposite. The water out of your tap is better than bottled water, because it has to meet all sorts of standards that bottled water doesn't have to meet. So, you know, you're getting better water and it's almost free out of the tap. So why, you know, you've got to be lunatic to buy bottled water.
Okay, here we are. I'm a Labour councillor sitting in the council, and I want some positive headlines instead of the avalanche of there's no money, or we're putting a flipping underground up to the Mendips for £4.5 billion that we're borrowing from China. Is there a case to be made? If you have a licensed premises in Bristol, you have to sell only aluminium or glass receptacles, ban the use of plastic cups in the venues, and ban plastic straws in all. And these are conditions of your license.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea.
Surely it takes no more than a local bylaw as a condition of your licence.
I'm not an expert. Is that doable under local bylaws? Can they make those conditions?
What do we think, Martin Summers?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I think you could start thinking about moving in those directions, as you say. I mean, they do have powers of licensing, but I don't know how much power they have to reject people who wouldn't play ball. You know, some venues obviously wouldn't want to play ball, and you've got to decide, how much coercion you're going to use.
Well, I guess the thing is, for the venues that don't play ball, then their public, their consumers, their clients can exercise their right to vote with their feet.
They can. I mean, the pub over the road here, the Plough, they don't do plastic straws anymore because it's part of the culture of what they don't do.
I get too many complaints. I mean, especially if they put a black plastic straw in my drink, that's going back to the bar with complaint. I didn't ask for it, and it's non-recyclable.
Yeah. Well, I've been over the way, they've got rid of them.
Good. That's important. Let's talk about the other Bristol Green initiatives, not the Bristol Green Capital, because we will never get the truth, apart from the beech tree, the beech nut tree that didn't drop any nuts that year, which is still one of my favourite stories from 2015. Bristol Energy is a council-owned green energy supplier. It's a good idea. There's a lot of high-rise buildings in Bristol, some of which may have spurious cladding. I wonder, heaven forfend, would it be an idea to replace that cladding with photovoltaic panels on each one of these buildings on the south and west aspects?
Possibly. Obviously, you want the insulation value of cladding to remain, so obviously you'd have to replace it with some fireproof cladding.
Yeah, possibly, or just a solar panel, because I think, you know...
No, you the insulation is very important. You want to make sure you're not losing energy, because, you know, heating buildings where the heat just goes through the windows and the walls is a monstrous waste of energy, and probably much more of a waste than would be gained by the energy you get from solar panels. So, you know, solar panels as well, yeah, not a bad idea, but not an instead of.
Okay, but, you know, these buildings, some of them are 25 stories high, kind of thing. That's an awful lot of acreage that you could have solar panels.
Yes.
And because they're so tall, they're not really in the shadow of anything else.
Yes. Yes, I mean, you know, I'm sort of agreeing with you, Billy. It's a good idea. How do you make it happen, I suppose? That's the question, isn't it? What's the sort of political mechanism that gets you there?
Stop overspending on Metrobus, maybe?
Well, yeah, okay. But how many of these buildings that you're talking about are actually owned by the council? Probably not many.
Well,
it wouldn't be aesthetically acceptable on the council house, so City Hall. So what does that leave you with?
I'm talking about the social housing tower blocks.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Barton Hill, where we are, Lawrence Hill, Lawrence Weston.
Yeah.
There's tall buildings in a lot of the city. St. Mary Redcliffe, there's a lot of social housing down there with lovely slabs of south and west facing walls.
Hmm.
No, Martin Summers?
Well, I think it's like all of these things, it's a question of where's the money going to come from to do all of this. Big projects and even small projects, you've got to find resources. And I would argue that we need to rethink the whole macro economy. We should be investing in all of this stuff as a way of stimulating the economy and of making it more productive in the long run. Mm-hmm. But of course, we don't do that because of all this austerity nonsense, which people have bought into, although they're now realising that it doesn't work.
Bristol City Council seem to be happy to run Bristol Energy at a loss.
Yes, well, that just shows you that resources are implied then, doesn't it? You've got to subsidise it if you're going to do it, to get it going.
Okay, so if they're going to run it at a loss, they may as well actually try and effect some positive change for the environment by the installation of solar panels on tall buildings anyway.
Well, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, Billy, but I think you've got to look at what, if you're going to put a proposal forward, you've got to cost it out and decide how much of a loss you're prepared to take.
Okay.
I think the inefficiency of putting solar panels on roofs in Bristol is.
I'm talking about on the side of the building.
I think anywhere on the building right here in Bristol, it's, you know, compared to the efficiency of what solar panels can do if you want to get into carbon offsetting and things in other parts of the world, it's not where they're going to get the most energy from.
Okay.
Here, I don't think.
All right. But, I just thought it might be a small step in the right direction. Let's talk about Bristol Waste. Because George came in and he thought, we've got to make some cuts. So he handed the bin man contract, I'm calling it the bin man contract, the waste disposal, which is essentially one of the main things that you pay your council tax for. That was outsourced to CETA, who did a terrible job, so much so that he terminated the contract early and then reset up Bristol Waste, re-employing a whole bunch of the people he had made redundant 2.5 years earlier. And they're not recycling black plastic. We are all paying council tax for this. This is rank incompetence and inefficiency, surely.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, how, waste disposal isn't easy, is it? Recycling requires resources and person power and you know, and money to separate out the waste. And there's a lot of waste that can't be recycled, as you say, the black plastic waste or waste that you can recycle, but you actually have to pay to have it recycled because the end result is worthless. So I don't think there's any easy solutions.
We're actually leading the way if you compare what we're doing to other cities in the UK, and certainly countryside areas. We can recycle a heck of a lot more here than, say, my mum can out in Weston-super-Mare, or my dad can living out in the sticks near Bridgewater.
Okay.
They're doing a pretty good job. Yes,
but, you know, surely we should be slightly better. We were the European Green Capital in 2015, the second ever city to have that honour bestowed upon them.
I think there's a scepticism about how much we put in our recycling actually gets recycled. And there was a case a couple of years ago. I'm going to be careful around saying that. But I think there was 6 months or so where what was going into our recycling was not getting recycled as we imagined it was meant to be. And so there's still, I think, some scepticism about bothering making the effort to clean out your plastic yogurt pots and put them in the recycling. You know, all you can do is your bit and kind of devolve responsibility from your side. But for me, when I look at a plastic pot and I think that that's 200,000 years in landfill, that's how long it actually takes to decompose. It's unimaginable.
What's the ferment amongst your peer group at the moment with politics, local and national, and most especially with green issues?
I think we're very environmentally focused. But certainly me and my peers and anyone that's been travelling as well. And when I say travelling, I mean really getting off the beaten track, seeing the beaches covered in plastic bottles and seeing deserts in Sudan full of plastic bags. What we can see that the developed world has done to the rest of the world in terms of bringing in plastic is really devastating. You know, two more blue whales washed up only last week in Europe full of plastic. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Attenborough's made a real impact, hugely. It's I think we're far more aware than the generation before us, and I find myself and a lot of my friends talking about how we're trying to almost educate our parents and our grandparents who still aren't bothering with the recycling stuff or buying you know, plastic plates for parties and things.
Mm-hmm.
There is more awareness, and I think, you know, even if you're working in the centre and you prêt à manger, you know, do coffee for £1 or £1 off if you take your own cup in, things like that. It's
okay. Other coffee shops are available, by the way. I'm not sure they're quite so green-minded. Martin Summers, is there a case to just bring in large-scale legislation for this?
I think there is.
You know,
if you're
Iceland,
serious, that's what you're going to do.
Iceland, the supermarket, have gone ahead and said, by 2020, January 2020, no plastic.
Yeah,
in
well,
our packaging.
I mean, if you remember when the Irish Republic banned plastic bags or made people pay for plastic bags.
22 cent. God almighty.
But I mean, it meant a massive decrease in use. I mean,
there's a lot of 80% decrease.
Yeah,
that was
amazing.
But
as soon as you say to people, you've got to pay for this plastic bag, even if it's only 5p, they suddenly don't want to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And that just shows how easy it would be to push this down
5p
if you were determined to do it. Well, you could make it 30p, and then you really will kill it off.
Yeah.
People will go to the... I mean, when I was a kid, I remember plastics coming in. I'm that old, where nothing was written with plastic. There was Bakelite, and then I used to play with my little plastic soldiers that I got from Airfix, and that was new. But I think there's much more awareness, as has just been suggested in the past, but there's a lot more plastic as well.
Okay.
Everything has become plasticized.
Well, exactly. So is there a case to be made for central government, if not local government, to just...
Well, I'm a top-down socialist. Of course, that's what you should do.
You know,
you just say we're going to get rid of it, and we're going to do it.
It would be great to see more effort coming from the top, because I think amongst my peers that we're very aware that all we feel that we can do within our power is to make as much effort as possible.
And private businesses will never move until they're made to move.
Mm.
If you say you have got to provide recyclable bottles, otherwise you get fined, then they'll all step into line. Mm. If you wait for them to get the sort of corporate conscience to do it, which is what, you know, why I'm not really agreeing, because there's too much freedom and libertarianism in there. You've got to be a bit tougher with them. You've got to break their back.
Well, if I cast my mind back to my younger days, there was a 33 milliliter can, aluminium can, easily recyclable, and then there was a thing for a while called a super can, which was half, this is for soft drinks, by the way, not for alcoholic beverages, and then all of a sudden the super can disappeared and you have a half litre plastic bottle, which is resealable, admittedly, but plastic bottles,
well, even cans
everywhere.
Have plastic inside them, don't they?
Mm.
And of course plastic, as we're now finding, is PCBs in plastic affect fertility for human beings and for animals. In fact, all the evidence shows that plastic is extremely dangerous stuff. But can you imagine if we were to try and get rid of plastic when it's become so ubiquitous?
Mm. Well, surely by dallying and not making even a small move in that direction, we're just accelerating things.
Well, I agree, and that's why you've probably got to make a big move. And that's why you've got to have a big, you know, an attitude, no, we're going to get rid of this stuff. And so plastic is still going to be useful. We're never going to get rid of all of it. Certain things have got to be plastic. But there's absolutely no reason, for example, people used to go to the shop and bring stuff home in brown paper bags.
Mm.
Or it was just normal stuff.
Take your jars to the shop
just
and
normal
weigh it
stuff.
Out and refill your jar. Which you can do at Scooperway on Gloucester Road. You can take your own jars in, refill on your rice and pasta and coffee. And
yeah, but I think it used to be sold loose, didn't it, and weighed up.
That's good to know.
And now it's a health foods expensive place if they're doing that. It's just traditional. That's how they used to do it.
But if you fine people, you know, you've got to have legislation relying upon people's goodwill and everybody sort of sharing and networking to do it. Mm-hmm. It won't happen. You've got to actually say, no, we're going to do this and then do it. So that's the sort of attitude they have in places like Norway.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, large-scale legislative change often has people pushing back against it. But I always use the example of the smoking ban.
That's
because
right.
I was in Ireland when the smoking ban was introduced there. I was living there at the time. And I was in the UK when it was introduced here. It's amazing how quickly people adapt. Just knuckle under and think...
Well, we've adapted to recycling. You know, 20 years ago, it wasn't anywhere near to what it is now. Yeah.
Okay, if you agree with me, boys and girls, then write to your local MP. Say, thank them, Karen... Kerry, Darren, do something about this. I wouldn't bother writing to Jack Lopresti. He's probably away. It's the Friday Politics. We've got about 10 minutes left on this evening's broadcast, after which you've got Mohammed Makawi with Leila Arabia bringing you some of his top tunes from Arabia and East Africa. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he's got for us in the pipeline this evening. But still with me in the studio, Annika Sutcliffe, Bruce Williamson and Martin Summers. Now, we've had a bit of a ding-dong this evening. What shall we talk about next? Because there are a few issues that I think need a mention, Bruce.
The beer keller.
Bless it.
Oh. Yeah, that's a bit of a shock, wasn't it? I mean, I'm like many of us, had a night or two down there in the past 20 years or so, and some of them quite enjoyable. It's sad to see. I mean, you know, the music venue scene in Bristol, it's under threat, isn't it?
And people keep telling us it's under threat, well, but the Fleece is still there, the Thekla's still there, Louisiana's still there.
The Thekla feels under threat from new development. The Fleece, similarly, it's all about noise, isn't it? Well, it's partly about noise, and I suppose in the case of the beer keller, there's other issues to do with the owners of the venue wanting to just redevelop it. I believe that whole block that the beer keller's in is going to be demolished and totally revamped.
Site of a former Fry's chocolate factory until the war,
really?
When it was blown up.
Why?
Well, there were eight of them in the centre of town. That's why Broadmead is as ugly as it is. But, you know, I mean, frankly, the beer keller has been a victim of gross underinvestment for years and years.
Yes, but that's what you kind of, you know, some could argue that that's what the music scene needs, you know, grotty...
Gross underinvestment.
grotty spit and sawdust dives, you know, that are cheap and cheerful, that allow, you know, promoters to put on bands for very little cost.
Okay. Interesting, but you have mentioned the owners on that, and Annika, there's another story in the news this week about what essentially I have to say was a very positive pre-mayoral George Ferguson Legacy, the Hamilton House Coexist project, taking over an old, disused council building and making it available to leisure and artists and other people. Of course, behind the scenes, the building itself was sold to quite a callous law firm run by a couple of Irishmen. And there's developments.
Well, the latest development, they've been really fighting to try and keep the entire space for community projects. The latest development is that they are definitely going to be losing part of the building, at least. Now, and I hear that the rent is also going through a sort of 400% increase on the parts that are for currently for community use, which is devastating news to people in that area, and the amount of people that will affect. I'm sure you know, if you live in the Stokescroft area, it's a massive hub in all sorts of ways.
Well, it kind of dragged Stokescroft up a bit, because, you know, when I moved to Bristol, Stokescroft was pretty dicey, and the one and only time I was ever mugged, quite politely I must say, it was in Stokescroft. He said, give me your phone. I said, I didn't have one, and I tried to give him my switch card. He said, yeah, you probably haven't got much in there either. And he walked off.
I mean, Stokescroft is still, you know, a bit sort of dodgy, rough around the edges, you might say, but yeah, Hamilton House is a beautiful place where actually the interaction between all sorts of different people in the community can happen. I mean, there's the big issue seller there who's kind of really well known. He'll give you some poetry, he helps clean the glasses for the canteen, and it's all a very loving, collaborative sort of atmosphere.
Okay.
And that's rare.
So what is this? Is this Bristol becoming a victim of its own square footage real estate value?
Yeah, I think it is, really. You know, the land in the city centre don't come cheap, does it? And the higher you can stack it up, the bigger the profits for redevelopers. So, if you're a community group, you don't make much money for the owners, so out you go. I'll redevelop and make myself a millionaire.
Okay.
It's all about money, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
then
yeah.
I think, you know, Bristol, one of the reasons I think it's special as a city is that we do have this community vibe, power to the people sort of thing. You know, we protested against Tesco happening on Stokescroft,
yeah.
and it's that area. It's got that feel of, you know, power to local businesses and rallying together, and they won't give up without a fight. There is strength in numbers there.
How much can we lay the blame for this at Labour's door, Martin Summers?
Well, I mean, the new Labour era was basically the era of lying down and letting this stuff just roll over us. And we've tried to change things within the Labour Party to try and make sure that's not the case in the future. But of course, you know, it's always going to be an uphill struggle if you want to do the right thing.
Okay. It's Pancake Tuesday on Tuesday. It's Valentine's Day on Wednesday. Can we finish on anything positive?
The sky hasn't fallen in on our heads yet.
Well, you wait till Wednesday, because it's Ash Wednesday and St. Valentine's Day all at the same time.
It's still just about light at 6 o'clock out. Summer's on the way.
Okay. Annika, you've got an interesting story from the Post, which we've been largely ignoring. Apparently, I shouldn't take my dog for a walk.
Well, you can take your dog for a walk, but if you need to be careful and keep it on a lead pretty much everywhere, it seems. The police or community enforcement officers have been handing out fines, even in Redland Green Park.
Interesting.
Cotton Park.
Were these dangerous dogs, particularly, that they were handing fines out?
Absolutely not. I mean, the article in Bristol Post says dog owners are furious. They've been walking their dogs, you know, more than 10 years in these parks, and it's important for the dogs to interact socially, make friends with other dogs, have a sniff, you know. And now they're being told that they're going to be fined £100 if they're not on leads at all times.
That's interesting.
This is not okay.
Are they targeting dog owners in Hardcliffe and Withy? And Capwell Crescent and
I just read
Lawrence
in this article
Weston,
that
Southmead.
The council have said that they have apologised. They made some fines inappropriately and incorrectly, and they've let people off because there are some parks in the city that are exempt. But how the hell are you going to know that when you just go walk your dog in the park? I'm not sure.
Well, read the small print as you walk into the park.
Thanks for that. I wonder if you'll be allowed to take your dog on the new Metro bus, or better still, on the new Underground.
Yeah, probably. You may have to buy a dog ticket.
Probably. You may have to keep it on a lead. Oh, yeah. We didn't even get round to magic ticketing. That's all to come next week. Don't worry, folks. We are back again next week at the same time. Jeff Gollop, former deputy mayor and conservative councillor for the Westbury on Trim Ward, is going to be in the studio with me. He is an accountant of some merit, so it'll be interesting picking his brains about why there's no money, Jeff, and why things are overspent all the flippin' time, Jeff. Anyway, have a great weekend, everybody. Don't forget to tell the person that you love them every day, not just on St. Valentine's Day. Do stay tuned. Leila Arabia is up next. Martin Summers, thank you. Bruce Williamson, thank you. Annika Sutcliffe, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Billy.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.